The call came in just before dusk, at 7:30 p.m. on June 15, 2020. A young man was down on a quiet stretch of Dwight Way, only a short walk from the University of California, Berkeley campus. The first officers to arrive stepped into a stillness that felt wrong for the hour. Cars passed in the distance. Porch lights clicked on. No signs of a struggle. No sign of a robbery. Just a 19-year-old student on the pavement, unresponsive, with a single gunshot wound fired from very close range. Paramedics worked fast, but the outcome was clear. The scene left responders with a simple but chilling question. Why would someone walk up to this student, at this hour, on this familiar route, and kill him without warning or apparent motive? The investigation began with that silence. Chapter 1. The Night on Dwight Way. The first officer who stepped onto Dwight Way that Monday evening could immediately tell something was wrong. The street was quiet in a way that did not match early summer near a college campus. A few residents waited behind caution tape, keeping back as patrol units closed off the block. Their expressions told the same story. They had heard something. They had seen the aftermath. None of them knew what had happened. Seth Smith lay on the pavement near the curb. He was 19 years old, a student at the University of California, Berkeley, and only a short walk from his home. The paramedics were already working when detectives arrived. Their movements were steady and precise, but the tone was low. After confirming there was nothing more they could do, they gave a brief, respectful nod to the investigative team and stepped aside. The time of the initial emergency call was logged at 7:30 p.m. The sun had not fully set. The sky held a thin band of late light that reflected off car windows and the tops of the houses. It was the kind of early evening when people were out walking dogs or heading home from the grocery store. Nothing about the surroundings suggested danger. Investigators began by securing the perimeter. Yellow tape stretched across the intersections at both ends of the block. Officers redirected foot traffic away from the area and asked the gathering crowd to remain behind the line. A supervisor instructed everyone to preserve the scene. No one was permitted to approach the body or step near the curb where early responders had already marked several points of interest on the pavement. The lead detective, wearing gloves and a mask, walked a slow circle around the immediate area. His flashlight moved at a measured pace across the ground, the shrubs, and the quiet space between the sidewalk and the street. He crouched near the curb, taking in the scene without touching anything. A single shell casing rested a few feet from Seth's position. It was clean and visible, lying just off the line where the sidewalk met the asphalt. He motioned to the evidence technician. Photographs were taken in bursts. Each angle documented the casing, the trajectory estimate, the placement of the body, and the surrounding environment. The team noted the lack of any scattered belongings. Seth's wallet, phone, and personal items were accounted for. Nothing appeared taken. There were no signs of a struggle in the grass or on the sidewalk. Whatever had happened had been quick. The medical examiner's early assessment confirmed a single gunshot wound fired from very close range. That detail, spoken quietly on the scene, shifted the tone. A close-range shooting without signs of robbery or confrontation raised new possibilities, but none that the team could assume. They noted it and moved on with their methodical work. A uniformed officer began canvassing the nearest houses. He knocked gently, aware of the seriousness of the moment. Some residents stepped out onto their porches and explained that they had heard a sound earlier in the evening. One person described it as a loud pop. Another said it sounded like a firework. None had seen the shooter. No one had reported an argument. There was no vehicle speeding away. The block remained strangely calm after the sound. At one address, a resident recalled seeing someone walking on the opposite side of the street around the time of the incident, but the description was vague. The person had been dressed in dark clothing. They were moving quickly. The witness could not recall a face, height, or build with confidence. The detective noted it, but understood it would not be enough on its own. Back at the scene, investigators examined the area where Seth fell. They documented his clothing, his shoes, and the direction he had been walking. They confirmed he was on a familiar route, one he used often. He was close to his home. Early notes emphasized this detail. The shooting had occurred in a spot where he should have felt safe. The lead detective spoke briefly with the first officer who responded to the call. The officer described arriving to find Seth already unresponsive. A passerby had called 911 after seeing someone lying near the curb. The caller had not witnessed the shooting. They had simply turned the corner, noticed a figure on the ground, and realized something was wrong. Investigators then began the controlled process of removing the body from the scene. The medical examiner's team handled the transfer with care. They recorded the time, documented the position, and secured personal items. Once the body was transported, the detectives returned to their slow walkthrough, examining every detail that remained. A campus alert went out shortly after. The message was brief. A student had been killed near Dwight Way. The suspect was unknown. Authorities asked anyone with information to come forward. The alert spread quickly through the university, prompting questions and concern. Students texted one another. Groups walked home together. The suddenness of the event left many shaken. As the night progressed, investigators expanded the perimeter. They searched gutters, driveways, and the grass strips that lined the sidewalks. They looked under parked cars. They used flashlights to scan for any secondary evidence. The shell casing remained the primary recoverable item, along with the trajectory estimates based on the wound location and body position. A crime lab technician collected the casing using standard procedures. It was placed in an evidence envelope and marked for analysis. Ballistics would come later. For now, the technicians focused on ensuring nothing at the scene was disturbed or overlooked. The detective in charge kept returning to the same point. There were no signs of robbery. Seth's possessions were untouched. His pockets had not been emptied. His phone was found near him, screen intact, showing no sign of being taken or dropped in a struggle. If a confrontation had occurred, it had been brief, quiet, and decisive. Meanwhile, officers moved outward into the neighborhood to speak with anyone walking nearby. Some people had only just learned about the incident from the flashing lights. Others had heard the helicopter overhead. A local couple mentioned they had been sitting on their porch earlier, but did not see anyone suspicious. Another resident recalled cars passing normally in the minutes before the shooting. Detectives noted the street layout. Dwight Way in that section has a mix of homes, apartment buildings, and student rentals. The visibility varies depending on porch lights and the angle of the streetlights. On that particular evening, several lights were on, but shadows remained in places where someone could stand without drawing attention. Investigators documented these sightlines carefully. The search for evidence continued well past midnight. Technicians measured distances between the casing, the victim's position, and the nearest curb. They marked small objects on the ground with numbered placards. Even a scrap of paper or a twig out of place could be relevant until proven otherwise. Most of these markers would later be ruled out as ordinary debris, but standard procedure required documenting them all. In the command post set up near the corner, the detective reviewed updates from the canvas teams. No witness had seen the shooter's face. No one had heard shouting. The lack of clear eyewitness information was troubling, but not unusual for quick, close-range shootings. The team would need to rely on surveillance, ballistics, digital data, and any trace evidence recovered at the scene. Just before 2 in the morning, a final sweep was conducted. The evidence markers were collected one by one. Plaster casts and photographs were double-checked. The shell casing and other items were logged and secured for lab transport. The tape remained up, but the active work on the street slowed as detectives prepared for the next phase. In their early notes, one line appeared again and again. The shooting appeared deliberate. That did not imply motive, but it described the clean, fast nature of the act. Seth had not been approached with a demand. There was no scuffle. The shot was fired at point-blank range. Then the shooter vanished into the ordinary rhythm of the neighborhood. Before the team left, the lead detective stood alone for a moment near the curb. He looked at the sidewalk, the houses, and the quiet space where the young student had spent his final minutes. He thought about Seth's age, his academic promise, and the abruptness of what had occurred. The detective wrote a final note for the night. It was plain but weighty. The question needed to guide everything that came next. What happened in the moments before the shot? With that, the first chapter of the investigation closed. The next steps would require reconstructing Seth's final hour, examining his routines, and finding the smallest detail that could explain what unfolded on that quiet stretch of Dwight Way. Chapter 2: A Case with No Obvious Direction. By the morning after the shooting, detectives were already piecing together Seth Smith's routines. They needed to understand who he was, where he spent his time, and whether anything in his recent days pointed to conflict. Victimology builds the early structure of a homicide case, especially when the crime has no clear motive. For Seth, the picture that emerged was consistent. He was focused, organized, and didn't leave much room for chaos. He was 19 years old, majoring in economics at the University of California, Berkeley. He was known for his quiet confidence and steady work ethic. Professors described him as thoughtful and disciplined. Friends said he was the kind of person who kept his schedule tight, but still made time for conversation on walks between classes. He lived not far from campus, and Dwight Way was a familiar street he used often. Investigators reached out to professors first. One recalled seeing him earlier in the week on a video call for a summer session assignment. Another described him as punctual and prepared. Nothing in their comments suggested a student involved in any dispute or risky behavior. He wasn't known for parties or large social circles. His routine was predictable. Detectives then spoke with his friends. They confirmed he had spent the afternoon working on a research project, then took a short break before heading out for fresh air. He often walked the same route in the evenings. It was a rhythm he kept even during the quieter months of the pandemic period. His phone records showed no unusual calls or texts that evening. His social media timeline was consistent with his habits. Nothing flagged concern. By late morning, detectives were back knocking on doors around the shooting site. The first night canvas had been broad but rushed. Daytime interviews allowed residents to see investigators clearly and recall details with less pressure. Some neighbors weren't home during the night, but were now available. Each interview followed the same method. Where were you at the time? Did you hear anything? Did you see anyone? Did anything seem out of place? Most answers were repetitive. A sound that could have been a firework. A figure walking fast, but too far away to describe. One person mentioned hearing footsteps, but could not say whether they belonged to Seth or the shooter. Another said they saw someone in dark clothing near the corner minutes before first responders arrived. The description was too vague for identification. Detectives returned to the evidence gathered from the scene. The shell casing had already been transported to the lab. Ballistics experts would determine the caliber and likely firearm type. Early assessment pointed to a handgun discharged at close range, but the specific make would require microscopic comparison. That process would take days, sometimes weeks, depending on backlog and complexity. Still, it gave detectives a starting point. Back at the station, analysts began working through digital records. They checked Seth's phone usage in the hour before the shooting. He had not called or texted anyone during his walk. Location data showed he was moving at walking speed. There were no abrupt stops or detours. His path aligned with the route he took regularly. Everything about the timeline suggested he was simply heading home. The team then began collecting surveillance footage. Modern investigations rely heavily on cameras placed on homes, porches, driveways, and small businesses. Detectives walked each block near the scene, noting locations of cameras. Some were active, some were dummy units, and some were too far away to be useful. A handful of homes offered to share footage from the early evening. That footage was pulled for review. The first batch of video showed common neighborhood activity. Cars passed. A few pedestrians walked along opposite sidewalks. A cyclist moved through the frame at one point. None of these images provided clarity about the shooter. One camera captured a blurred figure moving quickly down the street several minutes before the 911 call, but it was too grainy to identify details like height, build, or gender. Investigators marked it, but understood its limitations. Another camera captured the moment Seth walked by. He appeared alone, moving at a steady pace, wearing casual clothes. He did not seem concerned or aware of anyone trailing him. The shooter was not visible in that frame, nor in the minutes immediately before or after. The gap raised questions. Had the shooter approached from a blind angle? Or stepped out from a shadowed area between two houses? Detectives added those possibilities to their working theories. While detectives continued to trace Seth's day, they received updated notes from the forensic team. The close-range nature of the shot was confirmed. There were no defensive wounds. No obvious signs that Seth had anticipated danger. The precision of the act troubled the team. A robbery gone wrong usually left scattered items, dropped belongings, or some sign of a struggle. None of those indicators were present. Late in the afternoon, detectives received a small lead. A patrol officer who had canvassed a few blocks farther north reported speaking with a resident who mentioned seeing someone unusual in the area around 7 p.m. The resident said the individual had been pacing near a driveway and looking toward the street repeatedly. The person left before the shooting. The description was again vague, but the behavior sounded out of place. Detectives logged the note and planned a follow-up. At the same time, the case briefing to the public was prepared. Authorities wanted to reassure the community while avoiding speculation. They confirmed that the victim had not been robbed. They confirmed the use of a firearm at close range. They stated the suspect was unknown and the investigation was active. They encouraged anyone with information to come forward, especially residents with security footage or details about unusual activity in the area. The briefing prompted new calls. Some provided general support. Others reported sounds or observations that fit the timeline but were already known. One caller mentioned a person they had seen weeks earlier who made them uneasy, but the description had no clear tie to the case. Detectives treated every call with care, but remained focused on leads grounded in time and proximity. Later that evening, investigators turned their attention to the emerging mention of a possible person of interest. They did not release the individual's name. Instead, they referred to him only as someone who had been seen in the area around the time of the shooting and who fit no known reason to be there. They located this individual for a voluntary interview. The interview took place in a small, neutral room. A camera recorded everything. The detectives approached with steady, straightforward questions. They asked where he was at the time of the shooting. They asked why he had been in that part of the neighborhood. They asked if he heard anything. His answers were quiet but uneven. He claimed he had been walking through the area, but provided no clear reason why. When pressed about the exact time, he hesitated. They asked whether he knew Seth. He said no. They asked if he owned a firearm. He paused, then said yes, he had owned 1 month earlier, but no longer did. The detectives asked where it was now. He said he had sold it to someone, but could not provide the name. Each answer added tension. The detectives continued calmly. They were careful not to accuse. They were gathering information. When asked to describe his route through the neighborhood, the man struggled to recall details. He changed direction in his story. At one point, he claimed he was heading toward a friend's house. Later, he said he was walking without purpose. The inconsistencies were noted. They did not amount to proof. They did, however, justify further scrutiny. After the interview ended, detectives reviewed the footage. They watched the man's expressions, his pauses, and his uncertainty about his timeline. They compared his stated route with surveillance footage collected from nearby homes. They could not place him directly at the scene. They could not eliminate him either. For now, he remained a person of interest, not a suspect. Investigators returned to the digital timeline. Seth's phone showed a consistent route and speed. The person of interest's account showed gaps. They began checking bus records, rideshare data, and phone tower connections connected to the person of interest. These checks required time and coordination with agencies and companies. Nothing in the early returns drew a straight line between him and the scene. But the detectives kept the file open on their desks. The community tension grew. Students asked whether they were safe walking home in the evening. Parents contacted the university. Neighborhood associations discussed lighting, patrols, and the rare but unsettling nature of point-blank shootings. The randomness of the act weighed on people. Without a motive, fear took the shape of uncertainty. Meanwhile, the forensic lab continued working. Additional ballistics testing narrowed the type of firearm used. The lab reported that the pattern suggested a specific class of handgun, common enough that the result did not by itself identify a single owner. Detectives took note and prepared to cross-reference it with local firearm purchase records and any known owners in the area. Back in the interview room, the detectives prepared follow-up questions for the person of interest. They wanted clarification on his timeline, confirmation of his whereabouts before and after the shooting, and additional details about the firearm he claimed to have sold. The goal was to determine whether his story could be verified or if the inconsistencies pointed to deeper involvement. Before the second interview could take place, detectives received a new piece of information from a resident who had reviewed their own camera footage after seeing the campus alert. This video, though still limited, showed a person moving through a driveway near the time of the shooting. The figure matched the general shape and clothing seen in earlier blurred footage. It did not confirm identity. It did, however, push investigators to expand the search for connections. The detectives discussed their options. They lacked a clear suspect. They lacked an identified motive. They had a careful but growing suspicion centered on the man they had questioned. But suspicion was not evidence. They needed something more concrete. Something forensic. something that would tie a person to the scene beyond behavior or proximity. By the end of the second day, the case board in the command room displayed a map of the neighborhood, photographs from the scene, notes from the canvas, and the digital timeline. A single line was drawn from the time of the shooting to the person of interest. It was dotted, not solid. More information was needed before anyone could replace it with certainty. Detectives left the station that night knowing they were still missing the key connection. Somewhere in the evidence, in the interviews, or in the digital trace, the break they needed was waiting. They just did not know which piece would move first. Their central question held firm. Could they prove proximity, opportunity, and firearm access? Or had they anchored their hopes to the wrong line? Tomorrow, the forensics might answer. Chapter 3: The Break That Narrowed the Story. On the third day of the investigation, the tone in the command room shifted. A message arrived from the crime lab shortly after 8 a.m. It was a brief update, only a few sentences, but it carried weight. The shell casing recovered from Dwight Way showed microscopic marks consistent with a firearm already known to law enforcement from prior records. It was not a direct match, but the signature placed the casing in a category that had been linked to a specific individual in past incidents. That individual was the same man detectives had interviewed as a person of interest. The detective supervisor read the update twice, then set the paper down with care. This was the first time a piece of physical evidence pointed toward the person they had questioned. It was not the final answer. It was not the certainty the case needed, but it was a direction. A direction grounded in forensics, not impressions. Detectives reviewed their notes from the earlier interview. They had already flagged the inconsistent timeline, the shifting explanations, and the unclear story about the firearm he claimed to have sold. At the time, none of those issues could carry the investigation alone. Now, with the lab's preliminary association, they had a foundation to build on. The team prepared a request for additional data related to firearm history, including purchase records and any prior incidents where that type of handgun or casing pattern had appeared. A detective experienced in firearms analysis joined the case to help interpret the lab's findings. He explained that while the marks on the casing were not unique enough for an immediate conclusive match, they showed patterns consistent with weapons previously connected to the person of interest. By mid-morning, detectives conducted a second interview. The man sat in the same small room. He appeared tense but tried to maintain a steady demeanor. The detectives approached calmly. They explained the ongoing nature of the investigation. They asked if he wanted to clarify his earlier statements. He repeated parts of his story, but stumbled again on the timeline. When asked for the exact location of the firearm he had previously owned, he hesitated. This time he claimed he had traded it for cash, but could not remember when or to whom. Detectives pressed gently, asking for any details that could confirm the sale. He provided none. When asked whether he had been near Dwight Way at the time of the shooting, he said he had been walking but could not remember which block. The detectives ended the interview without accusation. They had what they needed for now. His uncertainty, paired with the forensic association, justified moving to the next phase. The lead detective began drafting the request for a search warrant. The goal was to locate the firearm or any evidence connecting the man to the shooting. The warrant was approved. That afternoon, a team of officers executed it. They approached the residence quietly, following procedure. Inside, they moved room by room, documenting items carefully. They searched drawers, closets, and storage bins. They looked for ammunition, firearm components, digital devices, and clothing matching the vague descriptions from witnesses. In one drawer, they found what they were looking for: a handgun consistent with the class identified by ballistics. It was not immediately verified as the weapon used in the shooting, but it was a significant discovery. The gun was collected, photographed, and sent to the lab for direct comparison. Officers also recovered digital items, including a phone and a tablet, which were secured for forensic extraction. The man was taken into custody for further questioning. This time, detectives asked about the handgun found in the residence. He said it was not his. He claimed it belonged to a friend who had left it there. He was unable to provide the friend's name. Detectives listened carefully and made detailed notes. His explanations now contradicted earlier statements about having sold or traded his previous firearm. The investigators did not challenge him directly. They simply continued gathering information. Back at the station, analysts began pulling data from the seized digital devices. They looked for location histories, message logs, recent calls, or anything tied to the night of the shooting. They work methodically. Digital forensics moves slowly, but every small piece can matter. Late that evening, a message from the ballistics lab arrived. The handgun recovered in the search warrant was confirmed as the weapon used in the shooting. The microscopic comparison connected the shell casing from Dwight Way directly to the firearm. The match was clear and verified. This was the break the detectives needed. This was the shift that turned the dotted line on the case board into a solid one. The investigators now had the weapon, the timeline inconsistencies, and the individual connected to both. The next steps moved from investigation toward prosecution. Prosecutors reviewed the case file. They examined the lab reports, the scene documentation, the interview transcripts, and the results of the digital searches. They prepared the charging documents. The charges included murder. The public was informed that an arrest had been made. The name of the suspect, previously withheld, was now part of the official record. The announcement brought a mixture of relief and sorrow to the community. Seth Smith's family released a statement expressing gratitude for the investigators' work and grief for their loss. Students on campus held a small memorial, leaving flowers and notes near the spot where Seth would often walk. Professors spoke about his academic promise and the impact he had made in his short time at the university. As the legal process began, new details emerged in court filings. Prosecutors laid out the evidence, the firearm match, the timeline inconsistencies, the proximity to the scene, and the lack of any alternative explanation. They described how the suspect had been in the area around the time of the shooting and how his shifting story contributed to the investigation. Defense counsel raised questions about motive. They argued that the prosecution had not established why the shooting occurred. They pointed out that there was no known connection between the suspect and the victim. They suggested that the lack of motive introduced doubt. Prosecutors responded by stating that motive, while often important, is not a required element for conviction. The focus was on evidence, not speculation. The court scheduled hearings, each one laying out more of the case in plain detail. The prosecutor explained how the digital timeline confirmed Seth's route and how the suspect's digital footprint placed him near the area. The defense challenged the interpretation of the data, but could not overcome the firearm match. As the case progressed, the charges became formal. In court, the suspect ultimately entered a plea. The legal proceedings moved toward sentencing. The courtroom was quiet the day the sentence was read. Seth's family was present. Members of the community attended. The judge spoke plainly, describing the seriousness of the crime and the weight of the evidence. The sentence reflected the gravity of taking a young life without warning. Outside the courthouse, reporters described the case as deeply unsettling. A random act. A young scholar killed within steps of home. The community reflected on what the loss meant. The uncertainty about motive left a lingering question. Students spoke about safety. Neighbors discussed lighting and patrols. The city acknowledged the long-term impact on the community. Detectives involved in the case also reflected privately. The break had come through forensics, not confession. The case had not followed the pattern of personal disputes or robberies. It had moved instead through methodical steps. The casing, the interview, the inconsistencies, the search warrant, the firearm match. Each step had been steady, not dramatic. The conclusion came from patience, not sudden revelation. In the months that followed, the university created a small academic fund in Seth's name. Friends and classmates remembered his steady presence, his focus on his studies, and his calm way of moving through the world. Professors noted his potential and the research paths he could have taken. His family spoke about his kindness, his discipline, and the possibility of a future cut short. The investigators closed the case file with one acknowledgement written clearly in the final summary. The motive remained unclear. The act was deliberate, but the reason was not known. That absence of explanation became part of the case's identity. Not every homicide ends with a clear answer. Sometimes the evidence proves the act, but not the intent. The summary concluded with a final line noting what the case had revealed. It emphasized the importance of careful forensic work, the persistence of investigators, and the strength of a community facing an unexpected loss. The case demonstrated how a single piece of physical evidence can shift the entire direction of an investigation. It showed that even when a motive remains unknown, the facts can still lead to accountability. When the file was stored, the detectives paused. The street on Dwight Way where Seth was killed looked peaceful once again. Students walked home in the evening. Neighbors drove past without slowing. Life returned to its rhythm, but the memory of that night remained. It shaped how people thought about safety, about vulnerability, and about the suddenness with which a quiet moment can change. The investigation had answered the central questions about who committed the act and how it was proven. What remained unanswered became part of the story's final lesson. Some truths can be proven. Others stay silent. The community learned to live with both.